though, is it's given me this space where I've been thinking about writing, you know, some of my little exploits and whatever from the game. I know what you did, but I'm going to go with it. But, you know, where it's just like, just, we got to have cruisers on patrol again, man. We got to deal with Orion pirates, like, just because, you know, the fucking, sorry, just because the, you know, the stupid universe is going to implode doesn't mean somebody's not holding the line somewhere. Like, I'd rather read about that than the 18th time that John Luke has saved the literal entire multiverse. Like, you know, give me a break. So anyway, that's where I'm at with it. So speaking of multiverses,
exactly,
let's talk about a different one. Yeah.
Yeah. The Dresden multiverses that are constantly in peril.
Right.
We just don't always know it.
And I don't know. I mean, for the Dresden Files, the multiverse was always in peril, at least, you know, that those were always the stakes. It's more like Dresden's figuring that out. And it's like, there is an escalation, but it's not like after changes, Dresden's like, you know, what's funny, to knock over every country in the Accords, you know? So we don't have something like that where it was like, well, we've already killed one kingdom, so let's go down the line to the next one. There goes the ghouls, the white court, the red court, the black court. Ah, hell, the fairies while we're at it. You know, like, it hasn't fallen into that kind of niche. Like, you know, certainly the Titan was, you know, adding, you know, escalating. Yeah. The kaiju's going to be there. But, you know, I don't feel like we've really kind of jumped the shark just yet. And I feel like they dealt with Anya in the appropriate, like, Harry's absolutely outclassed. You know how Harry beat her? Because he had a literal army of gods behind him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gods and demigods and their armies. And then she got tired. And that was just enough to give him maybe a chance, you know. It was a very Dresden telling.
And then he had Bob, and then he had Marcone, and then just like, and he had an island. He had a lot of
benefits. There were a couple of angels involved, a couple of demigods, a couple of actual gods, you know. Yeah, so, and the heebie-jeebies. Mm-hmm. So.
I don't feel that we've jumped the shark in any way in terms of the amount of escalation of tension. Like, we know everything's in threat and it's getting worse, but we know how much further we have to go. And so it can go even further before we get literally a big apocalyptic trilogy. So that kind of structure just means that, like, I know that Enya isn't the biggest bad that we're ever going to see. And this isn't Harry at his all the time powerful. He's still the lower on the rung of power with all of the demigods around him that had to help him through. But he now has to make alliances with people that he probably doesn't want to, because they were also there at the fight and they also have the same reasons for fighting, which Ebenezer is not happy about. White court.
Was that a more different segue?
That was a segue. I'm proud of that
fantastic.
One.
Fantastic. Yeah, that was great. I just was letting you know I saw what you did there, but mostly because I'm cheating and I know what we're talking about today. So
it's a fun problem that I generally always enjoy, of when you have to team up with the people you don't like for very good reasons and you still don't trust them and they still might backstab you at every point. But like, they are all living in reality. They all have to fight for reality to survive. And so Harry's going to have to fight alongside ghouls against bigger monsters.
Yeah, I mean, I think the White Court is more of a better, you know, like, they're a better point for that sort of thing, just because it's like, they're very much the bad guys, right? Like, but they're also, like, shaded by the fact that they are by design immensely likable, because that's how they eat. And so, like, and I mean I've had this argument innumerable times about vampires in general. Okay, so, like, let's just rip the band-aid off for that. I guess vampires are sexy because it makes it easier to get at your blood. Okay. And a succubus is sexy because that's literally their fucking job. Okay, guys. So, like, yes, it's completely understandable that you are smitten with them. And, you know, but the Red Court, it doesn't even hurt when they eat you because they've got that, you know, drug that, you know, makes it okay and whatever. I'm adapting an argument that was given to me about the Anne Rice vampires that was like, but people like to be fed on. I was like, yes, because it would be a whole lot harder to feed on you if they weren't faster than you, stronger than you, and you didn't enjoy it when it was happening. They're eating you. It doesn't matter how good it feels. Like, you know, they are bad guys. And so, like, Dresden, like, tying it back in there, it gets into a thing where it's like Dresden knows that they're bad guys, but they're immensely useful. They're playing each other, but they're just so damn likable. You know, like Ariana never tried to be likable. Ortega never tried to be likable. They were just Red Court vampires, you know.
They knew how to play the political game. They just weren't trying to be sexy.
Right. But like, yeah, they didn't try enough. And maybe it was Bianca fucked it up for them, you know, where, you know, Bianca just came unhinged over one person that she was also feeding on. And whatever. So they just didn't really try that hard afterwards. Like, they always tried to like bribe Dresden out of it, but they never tried to like get on his good side. Right. It was always strong arm tactics. It was always, you know, if it was always exploitation or, you know, trying to put him in a hard place or just be tougher than he was. And obviously that didn't work for them.
Which is why Lara is more dangerous, as she described in, was it White Knight? How do you have power? So you give people what they want, and then they come to you for what they want, and you are the one who doles it out. And that's what she does. She helps him, and therefore she becomes an ally, and it becomes harder and harder to turn against her.
Right. I mean, hell, that's something insidious to think about. Like, I'm firmly in camp. She's caught feelings, right? Like, I think she's got feelings for Harry, and all of this stuff is legit. But could you freaking imagine if it wasn't? Could you imagine if it's like,
it would look the same.
Dresden. No, but that's what I'm saying, right? That's what makes it insidious, is because you're not wrong, right? If Laura has been playing Dresden, but more specifically Jim's been playing the audience, because, you know, there's nothing in there to clue us into this that's happening. Harry is alone. He's got immense power. If he marries a mortal like Murphy, he's always gonna be alone. Laura can give him something that nobody else can, which is companionship for a very, very long
nobody
time.
But well, right, like, it doesn't
so
have to
far
be
the
she can
pool
get
is
him to
small.
Open up, if yeah. she can, if she is vulnerable with him, and he then takes that as it's okay for him to be vulnerable back, then that's going to be a significant moment, because he doesn't get vulnerable with anybody anymore. The only person he was vulnerable with was Murphy.
Right. I'm gonna put this out in advance, because I don't hate this idea, and, you know, I'm gonna run down all the branching multiverses to see where we wind up. But like, the main argument against it right now is because of Mab trying to ramrod it through, and Laura and Molly freaking out about it, like, whoa, he's not ready yet, you know. And that could have been, I mean, you could go all the way in, like, Laura is Darth Vader and she's Emperor Palpatine. She's so smart and so evil and she's so perfect that she knew that Mab trying to ramrod it through was the exact wrong thing that, you know, would have fucked up her entire plan, right? But not, you know, like, that's the one thing, right, is to say that, you know, like, if the marriage was her idea to get at Dresden, to give him what he wants, there's a piece missing there, you know. And I think that piece, that line, that incident, like, belies that, you know, that she was like, oh, wait a minute, this is bad, you know. Don't force this on Harry, you know. But I don't know. Either way, it's an important clue, you know, as to, like, how she actually feels about it. And to me, like, that's part of where I'm like, you know, I think it was mostly legit. Like, to me, the fact that Laura and Molly had the exact same reaction was that they were thinking about Harry, not something else, you know, like, but
yes and no, but it this is where it can look identical. Like it could be she actually cares and she actually wants him to be recovered enough to be able to take that step. It could also be she knows that the marriage would fail. Like he would just absolutely refuse to do it if they had to do it the next day.
Sure. Yeah.
It's and the evidence is the same in either direction.
Right. Well, and that's where it's like, you got to find the linchpin, right? You know, where would it be? And it, you know, in my estimation, all of their joint adventures up to and including, you know, like, the bubble incident and the numerous times he's had to threaten her with violence to keep her from feeding on him, you know, like, I think it's more, I'm still in camp cop feelings, but I'm not ruling out this other thing. I'm just saying, look, if it's going to be 50-50, I'm going to put my bets over here. I think that would be hella insidious. Like if Jim pulled that off on the audience, that would be wild, you know, like for sure. So now we put that out in the universe. So all 10 of you guys that are watching, like get the word out there and, right. You know.
Yeah. And she can have caught feelings and be just as insidious because she is also that type of manipulator. She knows not to do something stupid because of her emotions. That's why she had to cast out Thomas, because she knew what support she actually needed, even though Thomas was her favorite.
Well, I don't know. Like, we'd have to dig into more of that, because like, you'd have to tell me like, what is on your mind when you say that? Because to me, her casting out Thomas was a political move. She'd never actually cast out Thomas ever. He like, there was a period of time where like he didn't have the company card or whatever, right? So he didn't have the unlimited money. But like, other than that, like, she needed it to look like Thomas was cut off, but she's his contact, you know, for the Oblivion War, for crying out loud. Like, their blood, she actually cares for Thomas. We don't know that she cares this much about her other sisters, you know, or anything.
Probably
like
doesn't.
That.
I mean, right. She said so in Blood Rites, essentially, that he was her favorite and she always loved him.
Right.
And the other sisters, they're barely entities. But it did seem to hurt her, or at least it looked like it did, for having to cast him out and leave him vulnerable for a little bit. And yes, he still ultimately had support, but it took a while, and during which time he was in pain, and that bothered her.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, some of it might be the effects of having had to live under Lord Wraith for so long, however old he is and however old Lara actually is. We don't actually know, do we?
I mean, I think it's a couple hundred years. Like, yeah, I think she's like 1800s or something like that. So,
okay.
It's been too long because we got to do a reread, but you know. Once he gets past like 20% on the book, we'll start thinking about it. But
yeah, and that's kind of what Lord Wraith said in Blood Rites: of course, my children believe that family is all important because I have trained them to think that way. Right. When if for him it was just another way of holding on to power, so that they felt obligated to help each other and to him, and to have that loyalty. It's a great form of manipulation, and she's using it now with everyone else. Yeah. Even if she has got feelings, she can have set everything up in exactly the cold, calculated, sinister way. And it just helps to make it more genuine, which is going to sell it better.
Maybe, but I feel like if you're that cold and calculating, like, you're not the kind to catch feelings. Like, I don't know, they have to be mutually exclusive, but, you know.
I don't think they are. Like, you can be perfectly cold and calculating. Look at Mab, and she still loved her daughters.
Okay. I also think that the word love means something very different for Mab than normal people, but, you know. Like, I'm not going to deny that she has loved in her life, but I think Mab's like absolutely the kind that it's like, of course I love you, now charge. You know, like, yes, I mean, you might die, that is the point, you know.
That can be a reason of why she does everything. Why is she the guardian at the gates?
Right.
Why is she fighting so hard for reality? Yes, she loves reality and everyone who she cares about in it. And she's had a score of lovers, as she said, that she's had to bury, and every single time that hurt, but she had to keep going because of her duty. And some of that might be because her daughters are in reality and she needs to make sure that they're safe as much as she can.
You can't blow up reality. That's where I keep all my stuff and my exactly. favorite people.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But yeah, we're clouding things. Like, clearly she doesn't love like Titania loves. So that's what I'm saying. Like,
no,
I'm
that's
not saying
different.
Mab
it's
doesn't
not the
love,
same thing as but... whether they feel the same emotion. It's how they express the method of it. Titania loves and she lets it overrule her, but Mab loves and really. Lets logic protect her.
Okay.
There isn't that much of a difference between winter and summer, ultimately, except for the weird power scale of the fact that winter is guarding at the gates, and therefore Titania has to be the self-destruct if something goes too crazy. But it's the expression of how they feel their emotions. It's the rage unbounded on summer, or calculating predator on winter. But they both feel the same emotions. It's just a different method of expressing it.
Sorry, that comment is hilarious because we're also talking about Mother Winter. So if you want to talk about somebody that I'm pretty sure has never loved somebody else, Mother Winter is pretty close to the top of that list, you know, like, so.
It's a good one. And it shows the point of, like, according to Mother Winter, Mab is a romantic. She said that in Changes, I think, of Cold Days, when Harry was needing to get information about the island and figuring out what's going wrong with Maeve and everything. The Mab's attempt at symmetry, or like her threat to take Thomas as a Winter Knight because he's in love and that's human enough for me. He's vulnerable. He has something to protect.
Right.
And that is a through line for Mab as much as it is for Titania, just because what she says in Cold Case of, like, if you can think of a better way of funding this war other than stealing children, I'm all ears.
Right. Yeah, that's why you're not getting a lot of argument from me, right? Is that because the everything about winter, like, you know, you got to ask yourself, like, I get stuck in a chicken and the egg thing. Is it winter because it was always winter, or is it winter because of something else, right? Like, is it winter because of how Mab deals with it? And we know Mother Winter, right? But like, what were the Fae, like, it ties into the question, like, what were the Fae before the transition at the Battle of Hastings? Were they always tied to the elements? Or later, you know?
Like, from some of the various mythological research that we've done as episodes, summer is always a time of ease, especially in the British Isles, where a lot of these stories come from, that Jim is pulling from. And winter is the thing that you're always afraid of. And that's where, if you didn't grow enough food, you will feel that pain. If you did not do enough to protect yourself and your family, you will feel this pain. Winter is always it's the stones that they use to throw to teach shielding. And so it's that type of tempering experience that you need to be able to be stronger. And so when you need a defense, you need your Darth Vader, you need that type of strong aspect that's going to prepare you to actually be strong enough to fight the outsiders. And so
it's a shell. It's all a front. Mab is iced over and she's using logic as a shield to protect her squishy interior.
Yes.
Where the love happens. which yes, sounds but, weird to say out loud, but I'm just saying that's where, you know.
But that is the, it is the motivation. And it's like, if you do not learn from this harsh winter, you will suffer again in the next harsh winter. And because winter has the cold logic, just you see with Harry, when he has the banner and he feels all of that pain, it's the same pain that Mab has always felt. And they have to have that little protection of the cold logic. All of those lives that he felt lost, they were worth it because it helped them win the battle. And all of the other people that they saved. And he's like, you have to balance it that way. But if you're stuck feeling all of that pain and you're distracted by it and you cannot function, which seems to be where Summer comes in, if they cannot handle their emotions, they stop being able to function. But Winter has the, that coldness that allows them to. But they still have the same drive, the same urge to protect and to care.
But we also obviously see Titania put all that on the shelf so that she can show up, you know?
Yes. I mean, so. she has people to protect too, and a duty to fulfill, as she points out to Mab. She has her reasons, and it's just, but she didn't do anything for like 10 years because she was angry at losing her daughter.
Yeah, but that's like a blink of an eye to a fae. Come on now. Mm.
But it was very, very crucial 10 years. And it lost her lady. It lost her Lily. She could have protected Lily if she had paid attention.
Maybe. Speculation, but...
It is, but it's what was pointed out with Cold Days of, like, Lily was alone. She didn't really have all of these things. It's just her and Fix, and neither one of them really knew what was going on in a summer court. And Maeve was just not an asshole to her a few times. And that's all she needed, for someone who could treat her as a partner or a friend. And if Titania had done that and actually taken like a mothering stance of like, here's how you function, here's how you grow and be strong, then Lily wouldn't have been as susceptible. But Titania was absent.
Just wanted to point out, in case you haven't learned this before, not you, but like the audience, you, if... You know, this is a life lesson. So I'm an asshole, but I'm not always an asshole. And that's why people think that I'm not an asshole, right? Maeve is an asshole. She just wasn't two or three times, and that's all it took. So, you know, just be nice sometimes is what I'm trying to tell you.
I mean, even not even nice. It was just sometimes she looked damaged. She looked vulnerable. We saw that in Proven Guilty when she gave the lie that Mab was infected, and she looked scared. She looked vulnerable and damaged from it. And that's just all you need. Like,
Maeve is vulnerable and damaged. It's just also a trap, you know,
yes.
In her case, like, because even notwithstanding Nemesis, which obviously is an infection that made her change. Well, I don't know. I was going to say that like made her act against her will, but kind of like enabled her allowed will her. In a way, you know, but like even notwithstanding that, she's got several hundred years worth of mommy issues, so you know, still damaged. But for her, you know, she turned that weakness into a strength, you know, by trying to prey on people like, well, successfully preying on people like Lloyd Slate, trying to prey on Dresden with it, you know, that sort of thing. And ultimately Lily fell for it as well, but Lily fell even harder because of the whole, well, she can't lie to me. She literally can't lie to me.
Yeah. And so when you take that as ultimate truth, of course, it's going to make it look very real, but it's so easy and it's really, really human to believe that someone is an asshole just because they're hurt. Because they are hurting, they lash out. And so what if I just, if I'm kind to them and then they won't be as hurt and then they'll be better and then we're all happier for it. It's a theme that Jim's played with a few times, like with Lucio, like when she changed and she was mind fucked with pushing her towards Dresden. But it was hard for anyone to notice that it was changed because she was happy. You don't think of it as a bad thing when she became happier.
And Dresden brings this up a lot, right? Yeah. You know, like you don't look into it when your friends suddenly become happy because that's what you want for them. Mm-hmm. So you don't get too much into the why. You know, why are they suddenly happy? And if that should be a concern.
So. Yeah. Give them what they want and they'll be your cat's paw. You make them happy, and then all of a sudden they'll do anything for you because they don't want to lose that. They don't want to lose that for their loved one.
Okay, so let's retro this a little bit, right? Let's pretend for a minute that Lara is Emperor Palpatine. She's been secretly trying to get at Dresden and make him fall in love and all of this other crazy bullshit that we said. Wouldn't it have just been easier for her to keep Murphy in place? Wouldn't it have just been easier for Lara to come down and like shower them with money and favors and gifts and all of these normal things that would have manipulated? And he would have been perfectly happy with Murphy. And if Lara had manipulated Murphy, that would have been enough, you know?
No, because Dresden is so paranoid, he knows not to trust that. He doesn't need luxury. What he needs is someone who will fight alongside him.
Well, even still, like, she could have given, so she gave him that instead. She could have given Dresden everything that he wanted with Murphy in place, right? She could have been that
questionable outlay. Because of the true love protection, probably she still wanted Murphy out of the picture. Whether or not she would have done anything about it is questionable. Whether anyone anything to Rudolph to make that happen is also a very good question.
Right, but, which we still desperately need answers for so many years later. But other than all of that, to get that out of our system real quick. So like, but the whole idea of Lara trying to give Harry the kind of companionship that he would otherwise crave, because you're right, he doesn't want riches. Obviously, he lives in a basement, or at least he did. Now he lives in a castle because he got smart once, you know, but even still, he can't afford said castle because property taxes are a thing, Harry, and you don't have a job still. But anyway, you know, so like all of those upkeep things that are pestering armies these days, you know, like Dresden still has to deal with those. But like, in order to give Harry that kind of companionship, precludes Murphy, right? So she would have to get her out of the way to do the thing, and then the timing is suspect and all of that stuff. So that's why I'm saying, like, could she have achieved the goal without Murphy being gone? You know, could she still have been, I need Dresden on my side and whatever? And she kind of did. Like, they've been frenemies a lot, right? As Dresden would say, right? You know, like, they've teamed up plenty. Like, he likes her more than Marcone still, maybe because she's pretty, who knows? But, you know, like,
distrust more between the two of them? Probably Marcone because of the coin.
Well, now, but like, even accepting the coin, like, if he had to pick between the two, like it's tough because I'm trying to think, like, whose nature does he trust more? Because
probably
like
Marcone.
Well, I could agree with that a little bit, but like at the same time, like, Lara is supernatural, right? Hers is DNA. Marcone is like a moral kind of DNA. So it's like, you know, Marcone is still mortal. He could choose to do something else. He just won't. Whereas Lara can't, you know, in some cases.
So some of the friction between Dresden and Marcone is just because they're goats that are going to butt heads. They're just that those kind of assholes that are always going to do that to each other. But Marcone does have some amount of approval from people that Harry respects, specifically Vatterung. He would not be lending out guard to Marcone. But now Lara has Freydis.
He's also a mercenary, you know, as Vatterung.
No, Vatterung, Vatterung does not give help idly.
Well, yeah, he's getting paid millions of dollars.
No, he doesn't give a shit about money.
But it's the thing. Like, Vatterung is his mortal persona, right? So
he needs, there needs to be the debt that's paid, right? But Vatterung doesn't care about money. He took a favor from Dresden in exchange for a nickel. Yeah. He doesn't care about riches. He wants to position the people who are important to be able to fight the coming Ragnarok that he knows of. Money isn't the thing. He has been helping Marcone since Death Masks.
Yeah. Ultimately, behind the scenes, the reason why he's doing a lot of what he's doing is because Marcone is getting power to protect his people.
Yes,
right. Which is only slightly different than what Dresden is doing.
Right. I mean, it's the same thing. The overlap is they even share the same people sometimes.
Right. There is a lot of overlap. You know, I'm just saying, like, Dresden tends to do it with only the occasional burned down building, whereas Marcone, like, by nature of being a mobster, like, you know, people get caught up in the crossfire, right? Like, yes. Marcone's got rules and shit like that, but, like, he doesn't have to be a gangster to do all of these things in the same sense that Dresden's not a gangster. Like, Dresden's obviously a wizard, so that's a different kind of power. But, like, you know, if Marcone was just, like, a billionaire, could right. he accomplish all of the same shit without, you know, the drugs and the hookers and everything else, you know?
I don't know. Because Marcone was impacted so much by the child, Amanda, that got shot down in front of him.
Yeah.
He needs to make that underworld better. And he has, as much as Dresden doesn't want to admit it. He has made an impact on this that feels significant to him and is actually driving him to do even more. If he was just a billionaire, he wouldn't have had the same access to do anything. He wouldn't have the same drive. And what would it be his reasons for doing anything? Just to protect his shit, his cars, his whatever, who cares? He wants to protect the children.
Just saying.
No, he has.
I just realized I was like, if he's going to be a billionaire and fight for justice, and God damn it, we just reinvented Batman. But, you know, like, but I'm saying, like, you know, he doesn't have to do all of this, right? Like, he could just get out of
there. There is no one, you know, forcing him to do it. This is what he's doing of his own nature, is making the underworld a little bit better and healthier in this area of Chicago. No children. And the prostitutes are all cared for. They're all heavily
While
paid.
This all sounds good on paper, I guess the point that I'm getting to is that Marcone is still a bad guy at the end of the day, right? Marcone is still in the business that by necessity requires there to be imbalances of power and people to get hurt and to facilitate, you know, vices, you know, of all flavors and kinds, right? So, you know, so like, sure, he's not running around like eating people in the night or whatever, but like, you know.
This series doesn't allow for people to be black and white, good and bad. All of the bad people have reasons for it. All of the good people have corruption.
All of the good people?
I mean, name one who doesn't. Uriel, I guess.
Wrong? Like, I wouldn't even say Uriel, because Uriel is the wetworks guy of heaven, right? Uriel's the guy who did the plagues, so it's not like he doesn't have blood on his hands. But, you know, like, I would go at least as far as to say, like obviously the phrase doesn't quite fit because Vatarung has all of these different masks, but it's like he's never tried to be something he wasn't. But of course that's wrong because he's Santa Claus and he's Odin and he's, you know, Beowulf and whatever else. But, but like the only agenda Vatarung has is to protect reality. We don't see him employing human sacrifices. We don't see him, like, the worst thing that I could say Vatarung has done is that he works with Marcone. You know,
or so the worst thing that he's done is working with Mab. He's probably stolen children.
Well, that is conjecture, and that is not evidence. While it might be plausible, when you get some evidence, you can bring it to the courts. But, you know, until then, I get what you're saying, but at the same time, we haven't seen it. We know what Uriel has done by comparison. Mm-hmm. You know, even Dresden, you know, isn't 100% squeaky clean, obviously.
Of course not. No, he would be so much more boring if he was.
And I get that. I'm just saying, like, I don't know if this is a universe where there's only, you know, only gray and trending to darker and trending to lighter, you know, like, I don't know. It's tough. It'd be worth digging into more. But yes, like, most people in the series are some kind of asshole. There are plenty of the mortals, I would say, are basically innocent. But if we're going to talk about people with power and whatnot, then.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So Fort Hill is probably impeccable.
But not, right? Like, I thought he, like he's been special forces too or something, hadn't he?
And no, so
like he was
a lawyer before he became a priest, and so yeah. whatever ding he has on being a lawyer is something. Mm-hmm. And he had his secret.
All lawyers go to hell by default. We know this.
Yeah. So. And then whatever the special group he had with the tattoos and from they saw from Death Mask and the work that he did with like the Rourke from The Warrior. But that guy, he was a good person who got driven too far and went a little bit crazy. Morgan was a good guy that was an asshole.
Yeah, being an asshole doesn't make you a bad guy.
No, of course not. But like, even though he was an antagonist, right here. he was an antagonist because he was so much of an asshole, but he didn't do it because he was a bad guy.
Yeah,
and the series doesn't allow for people to be one-dimensional.
You should know better that being an antagonist doesn't even make you a bad guy, right? Like, you know, like
Murphy was an antagonist.
Batman's antagonistic with all of the Justice League, but they're on the same team. Don't tell Batman that, but they're on the same team, you know? So like, yeah. I don't know. I wanted to address something real quick here because Dwight is like, wait, is it Nicodemus Black? There's not much nuance to him, but I don't ascribe to that whatsoever, just to clarify. Like, first of all, when we were talking about like who loves what and everything, Nicodemus very much loved his daughter. That's why that worked, and that's why that hurt. In my opinion, this is completely my opinion, and I don't know if I'm alone on a mountain on this one, but Nicodemus is playing for Team Reality.
Yes.
He's absolutely lawful evil, okay? But that doesn't mean that he doesn't think that he's doing the right thing. He's doing what he feels like must be done to protect reality, which mostly means just killing a bunch of hyper-evolved monkeys. Like, if that's all it took, then that's fine. We're talking about, you know, trillions of stars and trillions of galaxies and, you know, all of this other shit. That's where Nicodemus's play is, in my opinion. That's what he's doing.
I agree. I think that's what all the hints have been, in that he found out 2,000 years ago of the play that was going to happen. He found this avenue for power for himself through the coins. So he, in order to get better, he needs to sow more fear and discord.
But, you know, I don't believe that Imperial a Roman tax collector magically found out that, you know, reality is going to get destroyed without somebody breaking the temporal prime directive.
Okay, I'll be much more specific. Nicodemus found Anduril and had the will to be able to withstand it as himself instead of being overpowered by Anduril. Anduril knows everything because it's a fallen angel. And then he finds out everything's at risk because of outsiders. And in order to get more power to be able to protect reality where all of his shit is... This is his avenue of getting more power, which is either artifacts, sowing more discord and fear, which apparently fuels the coins.
Just to add one more big log to that, Nicodemus probably already had a daughter. So not to protect reality where all his shit is, but to protect her, to save her.
Based on the ages, I don't think so. So Nicodemus is about 2,000 years.
I mean, Tessa looks like she's 16. So.
Right, of course, but like, I think Ivy said that Tessa is about 1,500 years, and in Skin Game, Tessa said something about 10 centuries to seeing it thrown away, talking about Deidre's life. So Deidre was about 1,000 years old.
Gotcha. Okay.
But he did have people he cared about. He had just reality in general to care about. Then he took a wife. Then he had a daughter, and all of that he didn't want thrown away until he had to. And it still hurts, and he's still trying to protect reality.
Right.
You think?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I think, you know, like, I guess Dwight brings some other nuance that should be discussed. You know, it's like at the end of the day, they want to rule the ashes. Right. But by keeping the outsiders out, you know, kind of allows for all of that. So like, yes, you know, like outside of the outsiders and all of that stuff. But that's where I'm like, I really feel like Nicodemus is the poster child for nobody thinks that they're the villain, you know, type of a thing. I think Nicodemus thinks that he's the guy that does the necessary evil. Yes. And I'm saying the words even, and I'm like, I don't know. There's a lot of fucked up shit that he's done.
Yes,
he does. Maybe even he doesn't justify.
But after 2,000 years of justifying it And even being right in some of those points, like stealing children, like Mab has to do,
right,
it does warp you after a long time, and you no longer be able to see what is accurate. It's the same description that they have for warlocks and black magic and all that. But to Dwight's point, is Lucifer aligned with the Outsiders or not? I don't think Lucifer would be aligned with the Outsiders, because just like him and Uriel, both of them want to protect reality. They're on the same side, right, even though they don't want to be.
Right. So since we're engaging with the comments still, so Dwight asks, what have we seen that Nicodemus is against the Outsiders? That's the speculation, right? I don't know 100% that he said anything. It's like circumstantial. One of the best lines that comes to mind is that when he sacrifices Deidre, when he tells her, you know, after this, the enemy can't reach you anymore. Well, who's the enemy? Is he talking
God,
you know?
White what, God.
Are we sure? Or is he talking about something else? Like, I'm admitting it is based on speculation, but it makes some more sense to me why he's constantly trying to bring about an apocalypse. He's bringing about a human-sized apocalypse, but he's doing this to kill mortals, to stop them from bringing in outsiders. That's my speculation. And granted, well, that's
Archeon years strategy,
of supposition chaos. And, you know, whatever else. But that's that's where I wind up, that it's like, that was kind of my epiphany, and maybe I'm wrong, you know, but like the only way that he thinks, well, and like the other part of it too, is like the reason why he thinks that he's a good guy is like, Dresden's like, what do you think? You're some kind of saint? And he's like, maybe someday. He thinks that what he's doing is good. He thinks that what he's doing is right. That doesn't mean that he's right. I'm just saying, like, from his own perspective, he's trying to save the world, you know, and it's all of us little monkeys that don't understand. But
yeah, because they don't have Enduriel.
Right.
And that came from Small Favor, which is also when he was saying this is endgame. He knows that the big bad things are happening very soon, and very soon to his perspective. So he needs to get all of this power as soon as possible to be able to withstand it, to protect whatever it is he can.
Well, and that, so, I mean, might as well throw that one up, but, you know, that's kind of the idea, right? Is that, you know, like I said, Nicodemus is the poster child for that sentiment that, you know, Nicodemus didn't just one day wake up and decide he's going to be a villain. You know, everyone's the hero of their own story. Everybody thinks that they're doing the right thing. Like Nicodemus is like you said, right? You're not wrong. Nicodemus is one of the blackest black and white characters that there are, right? Like he is so very much evil, but it's how he's justifying it to himself and what his ultimate actions are that given that little tinge of white, you know, it's like Darth Vader, right? There is still good in him. Does that mean he can be redeemed? Is that the story we're telling? I don't know. But, you know, like he's not like, you know, Tolkien evil, right? Where it's like one day the god was evil and he decided that everything that was light sucked and needed to die. And that's basically how the universe came about, you know, as we know it. Obviously, there was singing before that and all of that shit. Fine, whatever. But like in Tolkien's world, he's like literally, you know, we got evil out of the evil bottle and we put it into an evil god and it's evil, evil. You know, there's not any silver linings there. Nicodemus is like 99.9% dark chocolate, right?
Baking chocolate.
But just a little bit of milk in there, you know? So I don't know, like, you're not wrong. I'm just saying, like, from his perspective, there's a warped kind of logic where I think why he thinks he might still be the good guy. And like, I don't think he's trying to kill Dresden to kill Dresden. He's trying to kill Dresden so Dresden doesn't stop him from doing his work, you know.
But he wanted Dresden on his side, and right, he still would accept.
Probably, yeah. Especially at this point, you've got four of the artifacts. I've got the other one. But yeah, so like that's where I'm saying, like, you know, Nicodemus isn't like black, like it's very possible, even though we haven't seen it on screen or anything, like that's the whole war in heaven, you know, the entire angelic civil war might have come down to be like, you know, because I think we talked about this, right? We've talked about this with the multiverse and everything like that, that it's like, again, I'm falling on this grenade. I'm not speaking for anybody else. This is my idea. But it's like, in the beginning, God created the heavens, the earth, then he created some monkeys. And it's like, yeah, that's cool. But in order to do that, he had to separate the darkness and the light. And I think in part of that process in the Dresden Files meant putting the outsiders outside. You know, and so then he was like, hey, I'm going to make some life. And the angels are like, cool, we're life. That's totally cool. Let's do the thing. I'm going to make man. Okay, that's cool. They're going to have the ability to bring the outsiders back in. Excuse me, what now? We just fought for untold eons because time doesn't exist to throw these bastards outside. And you're going to give these assholes that don't know the difference between right and wrong the ability to bring them back inside.
And then there's something about an apple garden. And then they learn what right and wrong is. And then they.
But yeah, like, you know, like that's a different thing we got to discuss. But yeah, so it's like, and then you're going to let them just have the keys to the garden and all of this stuff. And like, you know, you kind of get into that whole Christianity thing where it's like, God is God. And when you agree with him, you're doing good and it's right. And if you disagree with him, you're cast out. So like, you know. You can argue about how much of that requires Lucifer to be actually evil versus he's just a rebel angel. But like that could be the whole thing. It could have just been like, hey, God, you know, I don't really think, and you're out. You know, like all you had to do was disagree with him. Technically, obviously, that is grossly, grossly oversimplified and whatnot. But, you know, like that could have been the whole war in heaven, right? And then you've got Lashiel, who was technically a fence sitter, which was, again, enough for her to get thrown out, you know? So that wasn't meant to be this episode. But, you know, I feel like it was kind of important to, you know, cover.
I'll just say so. As an aside, there's a book that I think I've recommended it to you, Justin. Terrain in Hell by Stephen Bruce is basically a book of exactly that kind of topic.
Okay.
It's
been a real long time, but I used to be like uber fascinated with that. And then adjacent topics like, you know, in D&D, you've got the Blood War and stuff like that, where it's like the battle of heaven and hell. And where did that come from and why? And how does that work with causality and, you know, just all of that stuff. So I'm reading, you know, because I don't do Reddit anymore. I've got time to read. So
amazing how that works.
Yeah, when you quit smoking and you got money for other things, it's like that, but with time, you know. So maybe after I get done with this Star Trek series, I'll take a look at that. But what was the author? Because I
Stephen Bruce find
it from that book.
Brust.
Stephen Era.
Brust.
Yeah, but Stephen. So
To
Reign in Hell. Yeah, I found it. And Roger Zelazny. Really?
I don't remember if he was involved. Maybe he wrote a foreword.
It says To Reign in Hell, a novel, Stephen Bruce, Roger Zelazny. That's I mean, that's Amazon, but
yeah, I'm gonna have to go back and look at my copy. I don't but might have been Zelazny who wrote the foreword. There was one that was kind of funny.
Yeah, introduction by Roger Zelazny. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. They were pretty close. One of Bruce's children is named Corwin after Zelazny's character.
Wow. That's nerdy, man.
Like, yeah, it is.
I mean, I'm not to throw stones, but I didn't name my kid after like somebody else's. Well, I kind of did, I guess, technically, but.
Yeah, you did.
So I guess that would be weird, but yeah.
I don't know. I'm named after a fantasy character. I have no stones to throw here.
Yeah. I gotta pick that book back up and try and finish that too. So it just like, it was okay, but I hadn't gotten to the parts where it was like blowing my mind yet, or, you know, where I was really hooked or anything. So
yeah, same.
But
So we were going to talk about Ebenezer, and I had that amazing segue and then we just, we've got 12 minutes. You want to?
We did us. No. We're going to save Ebenezer for his own episode. So, you know. No, because I liked where we went, which is why, like, at 30 minutes, I was like, yeah, we've got enough time if we pivoted now. But then we started interacting with the fans and, you know, like, answering questions and stuff. Like, yeah.
I know. So. I've apparently had a lot of psychologizing pent up and just vomited all out today. I love the complexity of the characters here, and especially the depth that we don't get to see a lot of, but we get to see hints now, and we're getting more of it out of Winter and out of Mab, especially Mab, of just like everything that she does obviously has reasons. They might not be understandable to a normal everyday mortal, but once you peel back all of the layers, they make sense. And if you have any better ideas, she's all ears.
Right. Which, I mean, that was such a powerful line, you know, and a powerful conversation, that it's like, you basically just added a dimension to this character with a simple line,
yeah.
You know, that was like, oh shit, you know, she's not the evil bitch queen,
yeah.
You know, of the world. She's just been in the job too long, just like everybody else, you know, like,
yeah.
So, I mean, and again, it becomes a chicken, the egg thing, right? Because the mantle, like, if Molly becomes Mab, she's gonna be Mab, right? Like, there isn't Molly obviously is, you know, tender and, you know, empathetic and all of these other things, but she's gonna have to develop that same kind of cool logic, well, and whatever.
I don't know. A long time ago, I thought that the line that says that Molly should have been better suited to Summer, and I agreed with that because of how caring that she is, but I don't agree with it anymore, and I haven't for a long time now, because she did go through a lot of bad things. She did have their phase as the Rag Lady that damaged her in ways that now she understands it better. She's not so naive and innocent to everything that can hurt. She knows how much damage she can take and how much everyone else can. And the reasons why you don't want it, or how much to allow. She got training from Leah specifically for very heavy reasons. And it wasn't just as being a backup. It's because she has the center of her family that gave her the reasons to fight and the moral quality to be able to figure out the right ways, even though she has to withstand all of the many impulses of the mantle now, all of the ruthlessness, the predatory, the territorialness. She knows why she's doing it, and she can keep that in mind.
Right. Well, I think it's one of those situations where it's like, if you had asked everybody, 10 out of 10 scientists would have agreed that Molly would have been better off, better suited in Summer, right? On paper. But when you really get into it, like all of the reasons that you listed out, she's perfect for Winter, mm-hmm. in a sense, right? Because like, it's one of those things, like, yeah, it's like you've got your chocolate and your peanut butter, but then they get together and you make something amazing, right? You know, I don't know if she's chocolate or peanut butter in this case, that doesn't matter. But the point is, like, you know, well, I'm just saying, like, she brought in some of that heart that mm-hmm. hasn't been in Winter for a very long time.
Yes.
And it's, but she's also able to be hard enough because she's got Dresden and Mab and Leah and everybody else showing her how to be hard, you know, and that Winter
needs. Even Michael, like, as much as Michael cares, he also knows that there's a point where you have to kill someone. And having that as an example is really powerful to her. Mab needs a connection to humanity. She had that a bit with Sarissa of going to baseball games or Disney World or whatever to try to understand humans and to still care. She knows that she needs that connection. If she loses that, then she no longer has a reason to keep doing what she is. And then Titania needs to kill her. Molly isn't going to lose that for the next several years, several decades even.
I hope it's longer than that, but okay. Well, you know, but it's one of those things where it's like, you know, it's been at least 80 years since Julius Caesar, you know, it's like, you're not wrong, you know, but like, hopefully it's a couple zeros on the end of that, you know.
Yeah, so. I mean, and we can hope with maybe her even connection to Maggie would last even longer than the lifespan of her siblings, but because she has that, she's not going to lose it. And but she has the anchor that Mab doesn't anymore. She's lost both her daughters in a way. And that's why she also needs Harry, because Harry has all the connections to everyone. That's why she needed Thomas if Harry wasn't going to take it, because he has someone that he can lose.
Well, and that just gets even more complicated now that we know Justine. So, mm-hmm. you know,
did Mab know that Justine was infected? Probably not.
Right.
But how did Mab figure out about Maeve and not know about Justine?
Right. I mean, there's definitely questions there. Like, she probably, I mean, it's her daughter, right? She probably saw the differences. She probably caught her in a lie at some point and just was like, that's not possible, you know, something like that. But I just had I interposed like Mallory from Archer over the top of Mab, like, you know, Dresden's like, why the hell didn't you know that Justine is like, oh, you mortals are all the same, come on now, who could even fucking tell, you know, right. Like, she just explains it away because it's like, oh, what, she got crazy and weird, give me a break, Dresden, you're crazy and weird, who's gonna know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, whereas like she can tell in the Fae because, you know, it's like, wait a minute, you're my retainers. We've known each other for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Like, what the hell, you know?
Yeah.
Like Leah, her handmaiden, and Maeve, her daughter. Maybe you should try getting one of the kitchen servants, you jackass. Like, maybe somebody that I don't talk to all of the time, you know?
Yeah. Maeve obviously was very important for them to try to get, because if she could kill Mab, then right. They have the everything's open. And Maeve was right. Too stupid to see how bad that would be.
Yeah, for sure. I was Dwight agreeing with me. So like, I just pulled
I like
the
both
energy.
These things.
Yeah.
Let's just do this. Right.
I know. Yeah. My brother would approve, 'cause he's been on, I don't know, still on an Archer kick. Like, he's been doing a rewatch, but like, I don't know if he's ever stopped rewatching it. So, you know, so
I've had faces like that.
Right. Had some of those pop in, especially the early seasons, because that's what I'm familiar with, and it's just like witty and funny. But yeah, like
tactile necks.
Yeah, right. So good energy for it anyway. But you know, because Archer and Dresden are also the kind of savants that are also kind of idiots, but everything kind of works out for them. So.
Exactly. It's like, how did you manage to succeed in this thing that you fucked up every step of the way?
Right. Yeah.
I love Mallory. I would love to have just more Mallory type characters everywhere.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we did it. We could of course talk, but there's nothing we're going to resolve in the next 3 minutes without going over by 10 to 20. But you know, So if Andreas was here, he would do a bad job of this. So I'm going to do it. This has been us. This has been the Dresden Files podcast. This wasn't even the topic we were going to talk about today. That's how good we are.
I had an amazing segue, like, and then we just didn't utilize it.
We steamrolled ourselves, you know, twice. So, you know, like, but the good news is we got a topic for 2 weeks from now. So unless we come up with something else again, you know, so.
Yeah. All right. But next week is more Lord of the Rings.
Book 6, right?
Yes, the finishing
final,
of it.
Final. I made it. We're to the end, you know, like apparently there's at least an hour, maybe two of them just being like, we did the thing. Spoilers for, you know, a 60-year-old story and a 20-year-old
movie. Yeah, then there's a lot of
movie,
appendices.
But, you know.
In my copy of Return of the King, it's 1/3 of it is book 5, 1/3 of it is book 6, and the last 1/3 of it is just appendices.
Right. And having looked at the appendices when we were arguing, I was arguing about that with Ben, I was like, yeah, I'm probably not going to bother reading those again, because I thought it was more like side story stuff, but it just looked like a lot of language and some other things. So I might go like pick at it a little bit, but you know, it's an audiobook. I don't really want to hear this guy teach me Elven
or Dwarvish.
Right now,
I saw a chart of all the Dwarvish letters. I was like, wow, he really, really put some thought into that.
It's crazy, dude. Like, you get to the end and it's like, you know, the poor dude is like yelling out in like 3 different languages, congratulatory, you know, phrasing. And it's like, yep, that was probably Elvish. It could have been Rohirrim. And like, I didn't even realize they had their own language, you know, like, like they comment on it, but it's not like I've ever seen it written down or anything like that. So, you know, it's crazy, but.
If we can get either transcripts or videos of what Butcher's going to say at the convention, we would absolutely talk about that, especially if there's anything new.
unfortunately not in Florida anymore. Dang it. So, right. You know.
So hopefully someone's going to take a video and we can all consume it.
Right.
Okay. Well, it's not a bad for not really having preparation, but we've got planned for next week, for the week after, and the week after that, and then we'll see.